This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. One of the pleasures of a summer night is the flickering light of the firefly, the lightning bug. Who among us hasn't marveled at those tiny twinkling flashes set off against the night sky? Did you know that the eggs and larvae of some firefly species glow? Thus, glowworm. The light these insects produce is called bioluminescence. And on the program today, we're going to take a look at what science is learning about creatures that generate light and how scientists are applying that knowledge. Our guests are two scientists who are also the authors of A Glow in the Dark, the Revolutionary Science of Biofluorescence. Their names are Vincent Pirabone and David Gruber. At the outset of their book, in the prologue, they write of scientists using a fluorescent protein from a type of jellyfish, a species of jellyfish, to study the components that form the toxic plaques of Alzheimer's disease. And at the end of their prologue, they say, the same protein that is being used to tackle Alzheimer's disease may one day enable scientists to directly link the human brain to computers, providing the ability to move objects and even fly fighter jets merely by thinking. And here's the final thought they offer as we prepare to turn the page. The scientific possibilities, uniquely beneficial and potentially nefarious, are seemingly endless. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Vincent Pirabone is an associate professor in the Yale University School of Medicine and associate fellow at the John B. Pierce Laboratory at Yale. David Gruber is a science journalist and doctoral candidate in oceanography at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Their book, A Glow in the Dark, is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. And may I call you by your first names?
Yes, of course.
Okay, very good. Vincent, David, welcome. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to have you.
Our pleasure.
Vincent, perhaps we can start with a creature that we're familiar with, and that's the lightning bug. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about that glowing creature that we're likely most familiar with, and then maybe tell us about all the many different other creatures out there that glow.
Okay, so maybe what I should do at the onset is kind of make a little distinction between bioluminescence, which we'll talk about, and biofluorescence.
Okay.
And the two are actually intertwined with each other, so that's why the book really covers both of these topics and why we chose to cover these both in describing this story. Bioluminescence is essentially the ability of living organisms to create light. So in the case of fireflies or jellyfish or the dinoflagellates that are in the ocean, these are organisms which perform chemical reactions, very controlled chemical reactions that produce light. And biofluorescence, which the book is discussing in the protein that you mentioned in your introduction, is a protein which actually doesn't produce light on its own, but rather scientists will illuminate that protein with one color light, and the protein will convert it to another color light. And bioluminescence has been sort of studied and for years, but this concept of biofluorescence is a more recent development. And in fact, the biofluorescence is actually becoming more and more important as a tool in biomedical science, even than bioluminescence is. And the reason they're tied together is because the first discovery of this fluorescent protein was found actually in a bioluminescent animal, and it was tied very closely to the animal's function. It's this jellyfish aquaria that was the protein was discovered in back in the 60s. So what we did is we tried to discuss, and we tried to bring up in the book just the course or the discovery process whereby scientists went through to discover this fluorescent protein. And of course, one of the steps along the way was the study of bioluminescence in all of its various forms. And fireflies, as you said, which is the one that's sort of most common and most, I should say not most common, but the one that's most apparent to most of us because we can see it, and we always remember it as children, they actually does not contain this fluorescent component. So they produce just light directly, the yellow light that you see when the animal's flying around. And the only place that this fluorescent protein that we talk so much about in the book is made is in these marine creatures and corals and in jellyfish. And but the interesting thing, I guess, the interesting thing about fireflies that would connect it to this story to us was that fireflies were the first animal that people recognized that the animal could control, as it were, this light production. So some animals just constantly glow, like dinoflagellates in the ocean, which glow when they're perturbed, basically. But they perform that feat. They produce that fluorescence in a different way, or that bioluminescence, than the fireflies do. But the fireflies control it very precisely, which would make them so interesting, the way they flash it, and the kind of a mating call. And the other animal, the animal that this fluorescence was discovered in, was actually a jellyfish that also does that, that very tightly controls its fluorescence and its luminescence. And people went in to study that animal because they probably thought it was similar to the firefly, but turned out to be very, very different, and opened up a new area of study, which then, during the process of that study, identified this green fluorescent protein. Okay. That's a long-winded description, but got us to how we you know, interweave these animals.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that at the top, because I wasn't quite sure when to introduce that.
it's complicated. I mean, we were constantly running into this, making this explanation, and that's in fact why we wrote the book, because we felt that although people were familiar to some degree with bioluminescence, just by coming in contact with it, biofluorescence is a little more difficult concept to explain and understand, but it's turning out to be extremely important to biomedical scientists, even more, I guess, more important than the use of bioluminescence.
Yeah. And maybe we can sum up here again, because I think the distinction is very important. Bioluminescence is the production of light. Biofluorescence is the conversion of one color of light to another.
Exactly. And the reason it turns out to be is a kind of a technical reason why it's more interesting to scientists. But scientists can take these components out of these organisms. Like they've taken the firefly protein called luciferase, which is a protein that even if you remove the gene from that protein and express that gene in another cell, if you add a substrate called a luciferin to that cell will start glowing. So any small organism that you can express the firefly gene in, that cell will start to produce light. So that was early on one of the first biomolecular usages of bioluminescence, is that scientists would take that gene and attach it to a regulatory part of a gene, put it into a cell of interest, and they could see when that gene was turned on by how much light the cell was producing. Mm. And that's how in many cases we in the laboratory will convert these you know, processes in organisms and use them in the laboratory as tools of discovery. And green fluorescent protein, the one that converts, you know, blue light into green light, has become almost the most powerful of those tools because of its versatility and because of some of its properties.
Yeah. Now let's bring David into the discussion. Maybe, David, you would talk with us a little bit about, let's go back and retrace, sketch out the arc of the story that the two of you tell in this book, A Glow in the Dark. The wonder that we experience looking at our fireflies, our lightning bugs on a summer night, this is something we have in common with the ancients. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about Aristotle's observations of creatures that glow.
Oh, that's very interesting. We, in doing this project, we decided to, since we're covering some of the researchers, and we kind of found this clan of researchers in the early part of the 19th century that were interested in bioluminescence, we decided to stretch this back and do a historical view of, you know, glowing animals, and how far back into history could we find, you know, written documentation of people studying bioluminescence, or at least being interested in it. And one of the earliest accounts we had was dated back to Aristotle, which he just mentioned, and I think it was about 2,500 years ago. And he wrote in a book on colors, he wrote some things that, which are neither fire nor forms of fire, seem to produce light by nature. And this was one of the first places we found that. So this this was, you know, we found ourselves going back into the very old archives and to pull out the original sources of this, and that's how that's some of the historical research. Then we also found some Pliny the Elder. We found some of his accounts where he was looking at bioluminescent jellyfish, that some of the larger ones, and around 79 A.D., right before he actually died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and he had made note of these jellyfish. One of the more kind of interesting ones we found was there's this clam that he had found in the Bay of Naples called a Pholus dactylus, which used to be eaten at the time, and it was a delicacy where people would, this clam, which ejaculates bioluminescence, and you could kind of see it as this twinkling display in the shore when the tide goes out, people would eat this, and they would sort of watch the, it was a delicacy to have the bioluminescent juices kind of dripping out of their mouth. So it was sort of a, some of the funnier and more unique uses in written references of bioluminescence.
Yeah. At the same time, other people viewed these glowing creatures with some trepidation.
That's right. That's right. There was, I believe it was in Italy, and even dating back into Dante's Inferno, where it was one of the first, they'd actually gone through a period of almost about 1,000 years where nobody made, there was relatively scant mention of bioluminescence because it was considered taboo. And they thought that bioluminescence and fireflies were actually the spirits of their departed ancestors. So that was quite, for Dante to mention this in Inferno was actually quite irreverent of him.
Yeah. Let's go back to Vincent now, and I've got another basic question I think we should take care of here. What's the difference between the light generated by living creatures and the light generated when we turn on an incandescent bulb in a lamp?
Yeah, that's an important point, actually, and a thing that actually interests many of early people about bioluminescence, and they coined the term cold light because to ancients, even to today, it was the only condition where they saw light and didn't see heat. So in other words, fireflies, to the touch, don't produce any heat, and yet they generate light. But every other instance of light, be it the sun or being burning or lamps or bulbs, always produces heat because part of the reaction of electricity, say, in a bulb, it's a very dirty reaction, as it were, and it produces light, but also produces heat. And that's the same case with the sun and everything. But fireflies, actually, in the bioluminescence reaction, is a very, very efficient reaction. So when these two chemicals react, the major output of their reaction is light. And so it got this term cold light. And it's the same situation as we now have in sort of glow sticks, where you break a glow stick, mm-hmm. and what you're doing is you're mixing two chemicals in the glow stick, and then when you shake them up, they mix and they cause a chemical reaction that produces light. And a chemical reaction that produces light in the natural world is fairly rare, considering the myriads of reactions that happen in our body. Very few produce significant amounts of light. And so bioluminescence, at least terrestrially on the Earth, seems very rare, but in fact in the deep ocean is quite common.
Yeah.
So it's a reaction that energetically is quite large because the energy required to produce light is quite significant.
Yeah. A relatively rare trait among terrestrial creatures, but in the depths of the ocean it's a very different story. Why is bioluminescence important to those creatures who live underwater?
Well, if on the surface of the Earth there's a lot of light, obviously, and the depth there is no light. When you get below 1,000 feet or so, depending on where you are in the ocean, the sunlight is almost completely absorbed and diffracted by the water. So in the very deep ocean, light is rare, and so if you produce light, it can be a good thing. It can be an attractant for your mates, or it can be a repellent, or it can be attractant for your food. So many organisms in the deep ocean, a large percentage of them, in fact, especially the small organisms, do this reaction, produce light, either as a way to attract, like I say, or as a way to attract food, things like this. The anglerfish is one we talk about in the book. The most one of the most striking examples of it that people are probably familiar with is these animals that live in the very deep ocean, and they have a little lure. When it's in the movie Finding Nemo, they have this tiny little glowing lure. And one of the interesting parts about that story was that the animals actually don't produce the bioluminescence themselves, the fish. They have no capability in their genes to produce light. Rather, what they do is in this little lure, they set up a little perfect culture environment that attracts bioluminescent bacteria to live in this little lobe, and only in this lobe. So they concentrate all these bacteria just in this one little lobe in their body, and then they can shutter it open and close a little flap of skin to sort of turn the light on or off. Mm. But otherwise, it's just a tiny colony of glowing bacteria living in this bulb.
Very clever flashlight.
It's a very clever technique.
Yeah, yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, two scientists who are also the authors of A Glow in the Dark, The Revolutionary Science of Biofluorescence. Their names are Vincent Pirabone and David Gruber. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back to our history. When did people begin to go beyond the observations that someone like Aristotle or Pliny made and begin to work on what allows some of these creatures to glow?
Well, I guess the person that we spend a lot of time discussing in the book, because we found that he was kind of the godfather of the science of this, as it were. Although there were some observations in the 1800s and some studies in the 1800s, it was a guy named Harvey at Princeton University who really began the most systematic examination, as it were, of the phenomenon. But he more studied sort of the extent of it in terms of like which organisms did this and what were they like, and tried to draw connections between these organisms, and you know, why do some bacteria do it, and why do certain insects do it but others not, and is there similarities in the chemical reaction between the two? And he really popularized the study of this, and he worked in a period of time during this, you know, expansion of scientific study where the study of biochemistry was growing as a science, and a reaction that produced light is a very easy reaction to study. You simply follow the reaction by the amount of light that it gives off. So that was very attractive for the early biochemists. But I think in our looking at it, sort of World War II was a very interesting time for bioluminescence, because as a lot of the war took place at sea, at least in the Pacific campaign, and there were large aircraft carriers and there were night maneuvers, bioluminescence all of a sudden became, and it was actually a big problem during World War I. It just wasn't as popularly understood, but the navies of the world recognized it during World War I, but it became a really acute problem in World War II, because the whole problem was that large ships moving about at night in the sea would produce these enormous plumes of bioluminescence from these dinoflagellates, these small unicellular organisms, and these huge streams left behind the boats are essentially a trail, and so any kind of naval operation that takes place at night, hoping to do so with some stealth, leaves this enormous, you know, record of its where its presence, which can last minutes to even hours following a large ship passing. And so people in the Navy saw this as a real problem, and with the advent of satellites and, you know, airplane reconnaissance, all of a sudden they recognized that they were no longer very stealthy, and satellites can detect this from space, and so these quietly, you know, silent moving ships were all of a sudden visible. Even submarines were visible at night. So they and the dinoflagellates do this in a way as a kind of an alarm system for not quite understood reasons, but anytime the water is agitated around the animals, they start to produce light. And so this became an acute problem for the military, and as a result, they began to study more intensely after the war this phenomenon and trying to understand how to avoid it and trying to understand if there was ways to suppress it and things like this. And that actually, ironically, led to a burst of research on the topic and a better understanding of how bioluminescence has sort of popularized the study of it. But it wasn't really until the genetic explosion in the 70s that the proteins that were involved in this could be cloned and adopted by scientists for the study of other processes like cancer and Alzheimer's that we talk about in the book. And our interest began with these proteins because of their enormous laboratory use. But as David said, we started reading about the history of them and found that people throughout history, as David mentioned, have been interested and fascinated by creatures that produce light. So children of all ages really are very excited by finding fireflies and just the awe yeah. the spectacle of those animals.
Yeah. So we have a problem with naval tactics in World War II all of a sudden, and I suppose then that leads the Defense Department to look into this issue, and we head back, in a sense, to the work of Edmund Newton Harvey. He was studying this, but he had a problem, a big one. He couldn't find a way to take the components and purify them. Why was that important?
Well, it was one of these vexing problems to biochemists. At that time, and even now, the way to study any sort of biological chemical reaction is to purify the components. And they had discovered years ago that the bioluminescent reaction really was two components, and they call these a luciferase and a luciferin, one being like an enzymatic a component of it, and another being a fuel, as it were. And when you mix the two together, the fuel would be expended as the light is produced, but the catalytic enzymatic part would not be. And if you added more fuel, you would get light, but if you added more of the catalyst to a spent reaction, you wouldn't get light. So this was discovered back in the late 1800s, and then Harvey was interested in sort of getting a better handle on what that was. And this predates modern science, in some sense, modern biochemical mm-hmm. science. So they didn't know whether it was a protein or a DNA or what. So his real goal, and really the holy grail of this science at the time of Harvey, was purify these two components to purity, find out what they were and how that reaction worked and what was its dependencies. And that's kind of what biochemists, you know, earn their living on even today, is studying protein function. And so Harvey, as you mentioned, Harvey enlisted a whole bunch of very talented people to study this phenomenon. But at the end of his life, didn't understand until doing the research for the book, he was very sort of unsatisfied at the end of his life, because in spite of his you know tremendous effort on the matters, he was never able to purify either of these components to purity after 50 years of work on it almost. So he didn't really know what the reaction. He couldn't study the reaction like other scientists at the time were studying hemoglobin or things like this. And so he was frustrated with it. And even though he was the sort of godfather of the field, towards the end of his life, he sort of went off writing enormous tomes on other topics and kind of was a little disillusioned by the field. And that was a kind of segue for another character, the sort of prime character in our book.
Yeah, David, this is another element of the story of World War II in your story. Tell us about the young Japanese.
Yes, we decided that to make this book a little bit more interesting, to kind of include a journalistic angle to it and really delve into some of the lives of the people that took part in this research. And one of them, like Vincent just mentioned, his name was Edmund Newton Harvey. He was at Princeton almost his whole career, about 60 years he was there. And we found this really stark contrast between the next character in the book, who is a Japanese scientist known as Osama Shimomura. And he'd actually, where Edmund Newton Harvey had gone to some of the finest colleges and had been a professor at Princeton, I think, at the young age of 24, there was the next guy who actually was able to bring these components to purity was Shimomura, and he had grown up during World War II, and he was actually a firsthand witness of the bombing of Nagasaki, and he was about 16 years old at the time, and he had gone through this extraordinary hardship where he'd actually saw the plane fly overhead and heard he was about 10 kilometers outside of the city. And he had gone into the city the next day on a sort of reconnaissance mission, and his school was canceled, and he had a hard time getting education, and he kind of wandered around the countryside for a couple of years until he just sort of landed in a laboratory in Nagoya University, where during the war there was actually this tiny little animal. It looks a little bit like, it's in the same family as like crabs. And it is it's called an ostracod, and it's a crustacean, and they're quite small. They're about the size of a sesame seed, and they dart around on the bottom of the ocean. They release these little spotlights of bioluminescence. So they had found out that if they could collect a whole bunch of these and crush them and mush them together and put some water on them, that they would actually glow in the dark. So the Japanese military during the war had collected, you know, huge amounts of these and had shipped them off to the soldiers so they could use this too. They would put a little bit on each other's back so they could follow each other through the jungles at night without using a flashlight, or they could put some on their hands so they could read a map without being detected by the enemy. So all this leftover bioluminescence from little animal was then lying in a laboratory, and they just sort of told Osama Shibamura, not knowing this long history of this entire group at Princeton that had spent, you know, several decades working on this. They just kind of gave him the task, said, why don't you try to purify this? And remarkably, in a year and a half, he did. He was about 27 years old at the time, and he was able to purify this for the first time, something that had eluded these Princeton scientists for so long. And as a reward for this, he was not even a student at the time. They just sort of handed him a PhD and said, you know, you've done something quite great. Here's your PhD. And shortly after, he'd gotten a Fulbright grant and was actually recruited to join the researchers at Princeton.
Yeah. Now, was he interested? You know, Harvey was interested, I think, in the science of it. Here, Shimomura is working. He's working on a very practical application. Was he interested in his work following his when he found the purification, a way to purify the chemicals? Was he interested in the application of his inquiry? Was he interested in, like Harvey, more of the pure science of it?
Not specifically. Harvey was almost like a Darwin type figure, where he would go off on these voyages of discovery and he would collect animals from all over the world and was really into the intellectual aspect of this. Shimomura, this was a task that he was given, and he did it because somebody told him to do it. And I guess he likes being assigned very difficult tasks, and he's very good at what he does. So no, they were quite different in that essence.
Yeah, in all the interviews that David did with him that we listened to, he was very much the purist in sort of the scientific endeavor, and even when he makes this discovery later, which has such a huge impact, he really is almost oblivious or uninterested in it. And we talk about other characters who immediately jumped upon these discoveries, but Shimomura was very, very concerned in this, as David said, this precise purification process and doing these things, and he wasn't interested in traveling around the world and finding new creatures and describing their natural, you know, history or anything, but rather just the very scientific basis of these reactions.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned the defense aspect of this story. Also, there's a medical aspect. When did medical researchers, people in the medical sciences, become interested? How did they become interested in biofluorescence?
Well, that's kind of the striking part of the story for us that got us interested in, is that Shimomura, when he came to Princeton, as David mentioned, he next began to work on this obscure jellyfish that, again, only these very few people in the world were interested in. It's a glowing jellyfish that lived up in the Washington State area. And it another one that Harvey had studied and not made much progress on. And so when Shimomura arrived in the country, and unfortunately just before he arrived, Harvey died, actually. But his students, as it were, who took over the laboratory with Shimomura, said that, you know, this is really interesting. So Shimomura again said, well, okay, let's work on this one. And he really, again, had no particular motivation in either direction. And he said, well, I'm here, and, you know, I'll do it. So they went over there. They worked on it again. Within a year, he purified this protein. But at the same time he purified this protein, again, which really had no interest in the larger scientific community, he found this contaminating protein, this green fluorescent protein, which he describes in this paper, and literally describes it in very good detail what it is. And it goes essentially unnoticed in the scientific field for almost 30 years. Hmm. There's a small group of people who are interested in bioluminescent chemistry that study it and work on it, think about this protein a little bit. But really, it's not a light-producing protein, so it's essentially largely ignored by the scientific community. And if you look at the publication numbers, there's maybe 5 publications, 10 publications in 30 years. And then another rather obscure scientist decides he's going to clone the DNA of this protein. And to give a little background, this protein, when it's produced by a cell, it's like I said, it doesn't produce light on its own. But if you, for example, have a bacteria cell that produces this protein, if you shine blue light on it, and then you look at what you're shining blue light on, but with a filter that blocks blue light, let's say a green filter, the bacteria will glow bright green. And so it converts this light that you're shining on it to this green light. So, but very, very few people thought that once you took this protein out of the jellyfish, would it still retain that property? In fact, everybody thought it would not, including Shimomura and everybody else involved in it. But again, this scientist who cloned the protein, really with no obvious intent, just thought it would be interesting to clone this accessory protein. He cloned this protein and then left the field of science almost completely, went to work for the government in a sort of obscure job. And again, the story almost comes to a halt, but then another scientist sort of grabs the ball, this gentleman at Columbia, who really makes the big leap into the biomedical world, this Martin Chalfie. And he just has this harebrained idea, well, maybe this thing actually will glow if I put it in these small worms that I study. So, and on a lark, even though all, you know, conventional wisdom is against him and says it really won't work, because there were other fluorescent proteins out there that mm-hmm. never worked when you tried to do that with them. But he sort of didn't know about that, which was kind of a benefit for him. He wasn't aware of all this, you know, negative potential. So he just had a student work on it. She subcloned it very quickly, this protein, put it into bacteria and into his worms, and lo and behold, they started glowing. So this discovery is what turned this protein from a sort of curiosity in the bioluminescence world into this extremely powerful tool. And that paper that Martin Chalfie published was on the cover of Science in the year that it came out. And it immediately was recognized by scientists all over the world as an extremely powerful tool. And so it was around then in the 90s, in the mid-90s, when that paper was published, 94, that everyone in the field said, wow, this is great. And then you start to look at publication records, and usages of the protein just go logarithmically up. I mean, thousands of papers a year start coming out, because the clone then gets sent all over the world, and every scientist studying their favorite cell and protein starts tagging their protein with this GFP, and you start seeing paper after paper and usage, and you just say, oh, my protein is here in the cell, or oh, my protein is there in the cell, because they've now tagged it with this little radial collar, as it were.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, let's go back to the prologue of the book in that vignette about a mouse and biofluorescence. Researchers are working with the fluorescent protein of a jellyfish to study the components that form the toxic plaques of Alzheimer's disease. Now, one of the details, David, in this opening vignette is this. This particular fluorescent protein is from an endangered species of jellyfish.
Yes, that is correct.
Is this an important detail and why?
It is an important detail because this is a story where the marine biologists, people that were studying these glowing animals, they were doing it for the sheer purpose of interest, and there was the jellyfish was called Aquaria victoria, and it's about the size of your fist, and it's sometimes in different times of the seasons they would really bloom, and the waters would be filled with these jellyfish, and at that time it was sort of a great boondoggle for bioluminescent researchers and marine biologists to kind of all gather on the banks of Friday Harbor Laboratories, which is in Washington State. It's a really beautiful, beautiful setting and laboratory as part of the University of Washington. And they would just, you know, spend day and night scooping out these jellyfish to then extract some of the compounds to study them. And some of them would come back each summer again and again and again to study these. And at one point, just recently, these jellyfish suddenly started disappearing. And Vincent and I, as part of the research for the book, we actually flew out there to Friday Harbor and talked to many of the people out there. And it's true, there's very few of these jellyfish around, and they're almost extinct. So what is interesting is that Vincent had mentioned how, in his field of biomedical science, this protein is extraordinarily powerful. It is a tool that has led to remarkable breakthroughs in Alzheimer's disease and cancer research. And this originally came from just this small group of bioluminescent researchers that were interested in a little jellyfish and were out collecting it. Yeah. So if that jellyfish is to disappear, which it is doing now, and if people hadn't discovered this protein previously, this tool that is now helping humans to, in such a great degree may have never been discovered. And it kind of makes you think a little bit about as some of the species disappear or do go extinct. You know, it's kind of this library of books that just are disappear, and we will never know what was there and what uses they could have had.
Yeah, and Vincent, scientists are looking for new proteins, among other places, in coral reefs, and we know that they are threatened.
Yeah, that was how David and I began our work together, our scientific work on this together, was this sort of last chapter of the story as it goes was, now this protein had been discovered and it was so important for bioluminescence, but as it turns out, to make a very long story short, it is not actually only present in bioluminescence animals. It's the only place that you sort of see it visibly, but it in fact is present on a larger scale in corals, which are non-bioluminescent animals. So these beautiful hard corals that you see on the reefs around the world are just replete with this protein. And if you go in and look at them with certain kind of lighting, you see that they express, you know, large quantities of these proteins. So a group in Russia actually cloned these things years later and showed that they were not just involved in bioluminescence. And so what Dave and I sort of embarked on a few years ago was to try to clone additional members of these family, because they're all very similarly related, but some of them actually glow green, some of them glow blue, some of them glow red. And we wanted to clone new proteins for use in our laboratory work, ones that had better characteristics than the ones that were already out there. And what we found was, we first did a sort of survey of the Australian reef system that we were studying to see how many of these corals produced it, and we were just flabbergasted by virtually every species that's out there at night just glows with the right kind of lighting, glows bright green or bright red with this compound. But as you mentioned, and as we've seen by cloning, there's a wide variety in these reefs, but as these reefs are extremely endangered and in peril of being lost, probably more so than almost any other ecosystem on the Earth. And I was unaware of this. David was much more aware of it as an oceanographer and marine biologist. And I've been a diver my entire life. I grew up in Florida. I've been in love with coral reefs, but not realizing that they were so gravely endangered. And as David mentioned, this was just the thing that kept striking us over and over again, that all of our modern techniques in biology, which we use these proteins, we were unable to create this protein. You know, even with the powerful abilities we have of molecular biology, we still cannot say, well, I'd like a protein that glows and really make one de novo. Nature still does that better. And everything else we would like, every other tool we would like, is probably sitting there in nature once we make. And we cannot produce those. We have to borrow that DNA from nature. And if these things disappear, and they are, you know, at a dramatic rate, we lose this. And I don't know what's out there. I don't know what cure. Mostly we just think about pharmaceutical cures and things like this from the ocean, which there are many. But there are also these tools, which are probably even more useful in a sense of what they open up to the world. And we've only begun to scratch the surface, the genetic surface of this library. And we've only cloned and we've only sequenced very few organisms. And so there are millions of them out there. And we were just struck and horrified by the idea that someday these reefs, and when I mean someday, I mean probably within 100 years, the majority of the reefs on the Earth at the present rate will be gone, because they are really like canaries in the coal mine as it goes with global warming. They are very, very sensitive to changes in temperature, and they are dying at an amazing rate. And so within the lifetime of our children, there will be very few coral reefs probably left on the Earth. And so this thing horrified me as a scientist and both of us, and that's kind of one of the reasons we began writing this story again.
Yeah. So some point down the line, children might watch Finding Nemo and it'll be a whole different story.
They'll think it's almost science fiction.
Yeah.
Sad to think of. I mean, I know that Florida, in my lifetime, even diving in the Keys, and David also did a lot of work in the Keys, and I did when I was a child. I'm, you know, in my 40s now. I was there when I was 14. I go back there now and it doesn't look anything like it did. Yeah, even my memory. National Geographic did this one beautiful issue years ago where they sent these very old photographers back to the exact locations they had shot pictures in, you know, the Red Sea and Florida, and retook the same image, and it was really unbelievable, you know. I mean, really horrifying. And these are places where people don't really live, right? People don't really live on coral reefs, but our impact on them is really unbelievable, not just from global warming, but from, you know, boat damage and all the other things that... I cannot imagine my children not diving into the ocean and seeing all that. It's really horrifying. I think because it is underwater, and there's lots of footage of it, people just sort of assume it's there and it's happy, but it really isn't.
Yeah. And before we wrap up, we have to talk about what all this means for the future of brain-machine interfacing. We only have a couple of minutes left, and in my introduction, you know, I quoted the two of you from the end of your prologue, the science of possibilities uniquely beneficial and potentially nefarious are seemingly endless. On both ends there, brain-machine interfacing could be uniquely beneficial and potentially nefarious. To sum up here, maybe Vincent, you would take this question because you're a physiologist and molecular biologist. What do we need to keep an eye out for? What are the possibilities and what are the potential pitfalls?
Well, we mentioned in the book, we describe a person in the book who had spinal cord damage. And this is where I come from the field. I'm a neuroscientist. And this is where our whole collaboration began. I use these proteins as a way to try to recover damage that happens in the case of like spinal cord damage. And what I mean by that is it's a very long-term project. It's not around the corner tomorrow. It's, you know, many years in the future. But we're laying the groundwork, myself and other laboratories around the world, for this approach. And what it is using these proteins as a way to not just tell that a cell is expressing a gene or not by being green or not, but rather to use these proteins to report what the cell is sort of doing electrically. And as you know, neurons in the brain are the things that control all of our behavior and all of our motor actions and sensory input. But when we have damage to, say, something like the spinal cord, where all this information flow from the brain to the spinal cord is interrupted almost irreversibly in humans because it doesn't really grow back, you're stuck with a person who has no communication between their brain and the spinal cord. And what our hope is down the road is to almost bypass that damage in a person and essentially read the thoughts in the brain, the commands of, you know, move my leg, move my arm, read those, interpret them as what they are, and convert those into actions by a machine. And that's what this brain-machine interfacing comes. In other words, for a person who is confined to a wheelchair and unable to ever move, to tap into the signals that are still present in the brain, the person's brain is still saying, you know, move my leg, but the pathway to get there is gone, and to bypass this and control machines directly to enable the person to then, you know, remove robotic instruments and things with their own mind. And some of these kind of things exist already that are measure muscle contractions and things, but they're not very precise. And going directly into the brain and measuring individual cells may give us a level of precision that allows us to say, well, pick up that ball and throw it across the room, that kind of thing. And the reason we say it's nefarious is as we, you know, in our little scientific world where we live in, we work in a biomedical science and to the aid of human beings, and we really don't think very much about, not always, but we don't think about the nefarious parts of this. But as mm-hmm. David and I began researching, we realized that, you know, listening to the human brain sounds like a pretty scary thing. And there have been attempts historically, as we know, to tap into people's brains, sort of Manchurian candidate kind of concept. And that's alive and well. And when you think that much of the research around this topic is actually funded by the Army, and not so much for, you know, veterans rehabilitation, but rather with that very concept in mind. And they've published and they've described their long-term interest of tapping directly into the brain to control, you know, machinery and instruments and things like this because it has a much faster response time and in some cases more accurate response than a person's own action. So they're interested in sort of wiring the brain in a way to control, in the end, things like airplanes. Many of the new generation of airplanes will be remotely controlled, as we see in Iraq, a lot of planes that are remotely controlled, pilotless. And so they're on the ground with joysticks, but their ultimate goal in years and years to come is that control be more directly from neuronal connections. And so here you have these two really wonderful and sort of interesting, if you want to say, usages of this technology that we think people should probably keep an eye on. And, you know, that as it moves forward, it has the potential for great good and the potential for other things, I would imagine.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank both of you very much for joining me this afternoon. Really fascinating topic. Very, very fascinating book, A Glow in the Dark. Our guests this afternoon have been Vincent Pirabone and David Gruber. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.